This is the 4501 Podcast, Episode 9, Hands-Off Investing with Robo-Advisors.
In 2019. Hey, Tony, how's it going?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you doing?
I'm chilling, man. I'm chilling. It is winter here. We just got some snow in Baltimore, but it's all gone now. It's kind of in the 50s Fahrenheit. But you're in a little bit different. Where are you right now?
Yeah, totally different. I'm in Melbourne, Australia, and it's been like 90 degrees Fahrenheit here the past few days. So no snow to be seen here.
No snow. Although, so next week I'm going to Las Vegas, and Las Vegas.
Oh, you are.
Yeah. And Las Vegas just got hit with some snow, which is going to be interesting for our trip.
I had no idea that it ever snowed there.
Apparently, it's like the second snow ever, or maybe this year. I don't remember, but it doesn't get that much snow, obviously.
Does it last throughout the day, or does it just like melt right away?
I don't know. The pictures I saw, it looked like it was kind of staying there, so I'm not quite sure if it's gone by now. But I'm sure it's gone by now, right?
That's so different than when we were there for your bachelor party. And it was like over 100 degrees.
Yeah, and it was like a dry heat also.
Yeah. Oh, totally, totally dry.
Yeah. So anyways, this is part two of our two-part series in investing. And basically, I think in the first part, we were talking about old school investing tactics, stocks, bonds, savings accounts. Those are kind of traditional ways to do it. But in this new modern generation of like tech investing and tech advancement, there's a lot of different apps out there and algorithms-based tradings that kind of have moved that gap from traditional methods of making money to kind of, I don't know, tech ways. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. The key here is like using technology and software to make investment decisions. And that's pretty much the definition of what we're going to be talking about today, which is robo-advisors. I consider it a buzzword, but it's a very popular thing, especially for millennials, to invest in these type of companies and algorithms.
Yeah, definitely. So I think let's go over, so kind of in the last episode, we went over ETFs briefly, but I think ETFs fit better here because they're kind of more of like a recent development. They aren't, I guess, I don't know, would you call them traditional? They're not really traditional.
I think they're becoming more traditional, but you're right. They are, still being adopted.
Yeah, because I read somewhere that millennials are the number one investors in ETFs, millennials being people who are born from like the late 1980s to the mid 1990s or 2000s. People who have grown up in this millennial turnover really like ETFs rather than investing in stocks. So that's why there's been such a huge push for it.
I just did a quick Google search and the first ETF was introduced in 1993. So that tells you how recent they are.
Yeah. And that kind of lines up with the millennial coming of age, I guess.
It does. Yeah. That's yeah. Right on par.
So again, just briefly, ETF stands for exchange traded funds, and they're typically sold and bought on the stock exchanges like traditional stocks would be. The difference is that a stock represents one share of one company, but an ETF is more like a mutual fund where it has a lot of stocks bundled into one, I guess, fund. So because it's bundled in with all these different stocks, that's what makes it a very attractive investment vehicle. It has less risk. It has less risk because of those multitudes of stocks built into it. So that builds in the diversification aspect. It's less work to maintain. So basically, these ETFs are actually actively managed by professionals at brokerage firms. And also, which is a big plus in what we're going to be talking about further along in this podcast, is lower costs. So the commissions to actually pay for these active or passively managed ETFs are lower than traditional mutual funds. So that's why I think millennials are kind of gravitating towards investing in ETFs than mutual funds.
The fact that millennials are lazy and they don't want to research all these individual stocks, it's a perfect reason to invest in ETFs. So that's just one of the extra benefits. And in addition to that, one thing that I wanted to talk about is something called behavioral finance. Have you ever heard of that, Mark?
No, it sounds like some psychology term, but is it actually real?
It's real. So when I was working at a hedge fund not too long ago, one of my coworkers wrote like the book, the textbook on behavioral finance. And she gave us like a couple months of classes in this subject. And it was really fascinating for me. It's basically, you're right, it's combining psychology with finance and trying to figure out why people make the investment decisions that they do. So there's a whole bunch of different biases that people have when it comes to investing. We won't go into all of them. We can honestly talk about them for multiple episodes, but one of them is called a confirmation bias. And when you think about it intuitively, well, let me give you the definition first. So the confirmation bias is the tendency to search for, interpret, favor, and recall information in a way that confirms pre-existing beliefs. So for example, we probably do this all the time. When you are looking for some information on Google, you kind of search for, you use a search term in a way that favors what you're looking for. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So like,
yeah, I do.
If you want to know if Red Bull is good for you, you're going to type in why Red Bull is good for you into Google, and then you're going to come up with search results for why Red Bull is good for you.
Basically, it feels like you're searching for answers that want to kind of support your ready mindset, like your mindset that you're already thinking of.
Exactly. So this same concept applies to stock picking. And that is a potentially dangerous thing because not everything you can read on the internet is true. So that's just one of the many different biases that falls under the behavioral finance category, the field of study. And it's really interesting, but I just want to bring that up because you completely eliminate those biases when you have a robo-advisor picking your stocks for you.
Yeah, so a robo-advisor, the actual definition of these investment vehicles are self-guided online wealth management services that provides automated investment advice at low costs and low account minimums, employing portfolio management algorithms. Tony, put that into words that the average person like me can understand.
Yeah, so it's just using software and algorithms to choose your investments for you.
Okay.
And there's a lot that goes into that, but we'll keep it simple for our audience. Right now in 2019, there's a bunch of robo-advisors, but the two big players that I want to talk about are Betterment and Wealthfront. I've actually had accounts in each one of these companies. Betterment was founded in 2008 in New York City, and they currently have $13.5 billion assets under management. While Wealthfront was also founded in 2008, they're headquartered in Silicon Valley, and they have $10 billion in assets.
So they both started up as startups?
Yeah, essentially. And they're doing really, really well. They have taken off since, what is that, over a decade now. They've been around. I had my accounts opened with them both back in 2015. I currently only have a Wealthfront account. I have a slight preference towards Wealthfront just because I've seen higher returns in my Wealthfront accounts.
Yeah. So you made a YouTube video about this, right?
Yeah, I actually made a couple YouTube videos. We can link that in the show notes if you guys are interested. It just kind of explains my reasoning for switching from Betterment and Wealthfront to just Wealthfront.
So what type of differences are there between the two? Because they're obviously the same in terms of the goals, right? The goal is to make you money in I would say a passive way, right? So you just put money in, they will put your money where it needs to be, and then you kind of just generate more money.
Yeah, it's kind of like a set it and forget it mentality.
Yeah.
So you set up these recurring deposits from your bank account to invest, you know, $100, $500 every month or every week if you want. And then everything else is taken care of by the robo-advisor. There's nothing else you have to do on your part. You just kind of set it and forget it.
So that being said, so before you sign up, how do they gauge your like risk tolerance and how much you want to, how aggressively you want to actually make money and stuff like that. Is there like a startup process when you first sign up for both of them, like based on like how you, like if you're, how conservative or aggressive you actually are?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And that's exactly what they do. In both cases, Betterment and Wealthfront, they try to gauge your risk tolerance. And I'm pretty sure they both use a scale from 1 to 10, where 10 would be you're more willing to stomach risk. And in that case, you would have to invest in more stocks as opposed to more bonds. And I think they approach this in a couple different ways. One way is that you say you have a goal in mind, like say you're saving for something, like you want to buy a car in 5 years, and you want to invest $100 every month over the course of those 5 years. Then it'll tell you if you should be investing in more risky or less risky assets, kind of like projecting into the future what you are expected to make over that time based on historical performance.
Okay, gotcha. So let's actually just get into the kind of the nitty gritty of the logistics of each account. So is there like a minimum deposit for both of them or no? Or do you have to contribute, a specific amount each month, like a savings account you have to? What's that like?
Yeah, so the last time I looked, there is a minimum deposit of $500 for Wealthfront. Betterment did not have that minimum deposit requirement. As far as your recurring deposits go, I don't think either one of them require you to have a recurring deposit. You could pretty much like just lump sum like 10 grand into your account and just let it go. You don't have to be continually contributing. And then as far as fees are concerned, each one of these robo-advisors has a 0.25% annual fee.
Okay. So what does that translate to in real life? Because, you know, 0.25, doesn't sound very impressive, but is it?
I would say no. 0.25% is a really good low fee that you should be looking for, or less than that, essentially. Let's say you have $10,000 in your Wealthfront account. 0.25% a year is $25. So that's relatively not a lot. You're looking at a little bit more than $2 a month to have the privilege of having that Wealthfront account.
Okay. And so based off your experience, again, this is probably in your YouTube video, but how much have you made since then? Just you don't have to give like a percent, just give a percentage.
So the market goes up and down all the time, but I think since I've opened my account, it's been over 15%.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, I agree.
And so what's the average S&P is what, 8% every year? I think it's over like a 50-year time frame. It's the average rate of return is 8%.
Yeah, per year. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. So I mean, that's you're doubling the S&P. That's pretty good.
Yeah, I'm super satisfied with my decision so far, and that is, I should note, with a 9 out of 10 risk tolerance. So if you have like a 4 out of 10, then it would be probably less than that.
So we weren't going to talk about that, but there's definitely risk tolerance should change as you age, right? So in my mind, the younger you are, you can be a little bit more risky with your money because you have so much time to A, make it back, and B, you're able to be a little bit more reckless. But as you get older, you should definitely tone down that risk management or risk tolerance, right? So if you're 9 at this point, have you changed it down to like a 6 or a 7?
No, I got plenty of time to be risky. It really is, you approach retirement, that's when you should start going into safer assets like bonds. But right now, our age, we're good with 9 or 10 risk tolerance.
Hey, you're an old man. You should be going down to a 7 at this point.
I'm like less than a year older than you.
You're an old man.
Nice try.
Yeah. Okay. But I think that makes sense though, right? Like the older you are, maybe at like 35 or 40, you should adjust your risk tolerance a little bit to switch that mindset from making money to preserving money, right? Because, I mean, you're 20 years away from retirement, if that.
Yeah,
and you lose all your money in 20 years. Not like, yeah. The time frame to you to make more money is just a lot shorter.
Yep, exactly. That's a really good point, and that's what most, you know, finance professionals recommend doing.
But what I would say is that if you're using a traditional method strategy, so like if you're investing in stocks and bonds, the process to do that is a lot more tedious and difficult when you're just investing in stocks and bonds. If you're investing in a robo-advisor, it's easier. You just go onto the website and just adjust it, right? You just go from a 9 to a 6.
Yeah. A couple clicks, you're done.
So, okay. So those are kind of like, we went off tangent a little bit, but what type of accounts are you able to open up in Wealthfront and Betterment?
Yeah, there's a whole host of them. The ones that I'm primarily invested in are IRAs and taxable accounts. So there's a bunch of different IRAs, but the ones that people hear about the most are Roth and traditional IRAs. Do you know the difference between those?
I think so. So I'm a Roth man, an R-O-T-H, Roth man. because since I'm a student, I have to deal with my own retirement accounts. I there's no way I can actually go through my school system and anything like that. Which is kind of a bummer, but at the same time, it's just like a lot easier for me to just deal with because I get to invest in the funds that I want to invest in. But in any case, basically the difference between a Roth IRA and IRA stands for what? Individual retirement account?
I believe so.
Yeah. So the difference between a Roth and a traditional is one, the traditional IRA, you're able to use pre-tax dollars to put into your account. Whereas for the Roth IRA, you're able to use post-tax dollars to put into your account. And that kind of differs mainly between the two. So there's a lot of technical differences, but for the most part, when you actually withdraw your money when you retire, the money from a Roth IRA is not taxable, whereas from a traditional IRA, it is taxable. So what's the thinking behind that? If you're trying to decide between a Roth IRA and a traditional IRA, it's basically your tax bracket, right?
It's partially your tax bracket, but what I've heard in the past is that if you think that taxes are going to be higher when you retire, then you should invest in a Roth because you won't be taxed at that time. But if you think taxes are going to stay the same or maybe go down, then you should invest in traditional IRA as opposed to the Roth.
Okay. I got you. So so obviously every situation is going to vary.
Yeah, but like you said, you're a Roth guy, I'm a Roth guy. So I think just the fact that we're young and we think that taxes are going to go up as we age is the reason to do Roth. And that being said, you can also do 50-50, like do half in Roth, half in traditional, and that way you are covered in both cases.
And you can convert between the two.
Like, yeah.
You can't, right? Can you go from traditional Roth and then Roth? I don't think you can only go one way. And I don't remember which way it is.
I'm not sure. I don't want to say the wrong thing, but I would think you can.
It's called backdooring.
Backdooring.
I think it's called a backdoor IRA, but look that up. That's beyond the scopes of this podcast, because I think it actually is kind of like a janky way to kind of avert tax laws.
maybe I'll look into that then.
Yeah. So if you go find an accountant, he'll help you out with that type of stuff. But in any case, Roth IRA, traditional IRAs are the kind of the two main vehicles for Betterment and Wealthfront. But with that being said, you can choose either one, but the main kind of theme here is that the deposit levels are fairly low for each one, but the annual fees are a lot lower. And fees are what's going to kill you, right? Like,
yeah, we talked about that last week. Fees, the higher the fee, obviously, that compounding again that we talked about last week is going to snowball pretty much, and you're going to be paying a lot more in the long run with a higher fee than a lower fee. So a 0.25% annual fee is pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, think about it this way. Any fees that you have to pay is taking away from your profit. So that's the bottom line. You want low fees so you can get the most profit available.
Yep. And while we're speaking about fees, I do want to point out that there's actually two levels of fees when you have one of these accounts.
Okay.
The one that most people know about is the one that the platforms advertise. That's the 0.25% that we're talking about. But little do they know, well, some people know, and we're going to tell you, each individual ETF that you own as part of your robo-advisor has underlying fees.
Well, that goes back to the fact that they're actively managed by a person.
Yeah, you're right. Yep. So that secondary level of fees goes to the ETF owners, I would say. Is it an owner?
It's get passed on to the, yeah, ETF owner. I would
the
say
manager.
If you own, yeah. So basically, wait, what do you mean by manager?
Like the manager of the ETF?
The portfolio manager?
I guess we can consider it that.
No, they're called that. So basically you're paying the portfolio manager and his company the fees to manage your money. Yeah.
Yep. So you're paying some fees to that guy and some fees to the robo-advisor. But these underlying fees to the ETFs aren't really advertised really well, in my opinion, for to the end consumer, to the customer. You have to do some digging in order to find what you're actually paying under the hood.
Okay, so how, what type of digging do you have to do? Explain it.
There is something called an investment prospectus. And what this is essentially a really good description that breaks down what the goal of the ETF is, what the fees of the ETF are, and a whole bunch of other stuff that is really honestly over my head. So what I did before we started recording is I pulled up a couple of these investment prospectuses, and just to give you guys an idea about what to expect with some of these ETFs. So the first one that I know for sure is a Wealthfront ETF that you will be invested in is the SCHB, Schwab US Broad Market ETF. And what the goal of this fund is to track as closely as possible the total return of the Dow Jones US Broad Stock Market Index. And this ETF has a management fee of just 0.03%, which, you know, is $3 every year, essentially with a $10,000 deposit. Over 10 years, that's only $39. So it's very, very low.
Yep. And I would say that there are comparable ETFs like SCHB, right? And so I'm invested in an ETF called VTI.
Do you know what that stands for?
Vanguard Total Stock Market Index.
Okay.
And it's essentially the same thing. I guess we can't really give out advice whether or not to. We shouldn't. We're not giving out advice as to which ones you should buy.
Disclaimer.
Disclaimer, because I don't want to get in trouble by the SEC, even though no one from the SEC would probably listen to this podcast. We're not giving out advice. This is unsolicited advice. This is not advice.
This is just a conversation.
This is just exactly. But basically, you'll find other vehicles like this. And so if you didn't want to go into robo-advisors, there are general stock market indices that you can actually buy ETFs that are tailored towards. I guess going on to fees also, we'll talk about a couple more. But that's a low fee one, right?
Oh, totally. I don't think they get much lower than that. Actually, I've heard recently that there are some no-fee ETFs, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah, I don't know how they would make money off of that then.
I don't know either. I would like to do some research into that. Maybe in the... I'll look into that and put it in the blog post associated with this episode, which we are working hard on our website, and you can access the show notes at the 4501podcast.com/9 in this case, because this is episode 9, and that'll take you directly to the show notes page with any additional information that we decide to publish in regards to this episode.
Yep. So kind of piggybacking off that, without being overly specific, I would say that the more specific your ETFs get, so like a sector ETF, like consumer staples or energy, the more specific your ETFs get, the higher the management fee. And so ETFs are kind of cool in the sense that you can get themes associated with them. So one actually, an ETF that I actually seen before is called the Millennials Thematic ETF, MILN. It's a very specific one because it tracks companies that millennials seem to like. So a couple of them would be Starbucks. All millennials love Starbucks. PayPal Holdings. All millennials love Venmo. Costco. All millennials love Costco. They like buying in bulk. And Nike. So Oh, and Amazon. Okay, so these are companies that if you're around the age of 30, you use these companies almost on a daily basis. And so because it's so specific to what millennials will shop at, so the management fee is really high. It's 0.68%. So it's a very high management fee.
It's like 20 times more than the total market index that we talked about.
Yeah, so it's a very high fee because it is specific, though. I mean, there's probably some other stuff involved, but what I would say is that there's a lot more risk associated into an ETF like this because it is just less diverse since you're targeting a singular, like a specific company as opposed to tracking an index. But overall, 0.68, very high.
Yeah, Mark, that's a good contrast between, you know, the different examples of ETFs that you could potentially invest in. Is that all we want to talk about today?
Yes.
What are we talking about next week?
So next week we will be talking about something that is kind of a hobby for a lot of people, and that is award traveling. So what is award traveling? Tony, do you know what award traveling is?
Do you mean reward traveling?
Reward or award, doesn't matter.
It's
You're traveling for fun and for free in most cases.
It's with points, isn't it?
It's with points, it's with miles, it's with rewards, it's with anything.
I would consider you the expert with this. I only recently had my first points purchase and I really enjoyed it, but you've been doing this for quite some time.
Yeah, so just as a little bit of background, I went to a honeymoon to the islands of Maui and Oahu on points for the most part. And so we also recently went on a trip to Italy, France, and London on points. So I think we have a very good idea of the system involved and how to generate as much points as possible. It's a very hot topic nowadays. So if you're a millennial, you definitely should have a rewards card. And we're not going to drop a referral link, so we won't get money from this. So it should be a good podcast, though.
Yeah, totally. So taking a break from technology, talking about travel next week.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time, guys. And girls. And girls. We'll see you next time, guys and girls.
Later.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this episode. Please follow us on Twitter at the 451 Podcast to keep up with the latest news and events. If you have any suggestions for episodes or would like to contact us, shoot us an email at the451podcast@gmail.com.